Good evening, everyone. It's great to see each of you here tonight, and it's great to have visitors with us. We appreciate not only the members here who gather together, we edify one another, but then we have those who come from elsewhere, and we appreciate you coming and joining in this effort to lift up the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, and I might note, we're halfway through this. I was thinking about this morning, and I thought, there are 6 lessons in this series, and yesterday took 3 of them, and there are only 3 left. So we're halfway through it. Tonight's lesson may seem a little strange to you. As I mentioned last night, there should not be a question mark on the end of this. The truth is, you don't own anything. You say, well, Bob, yeah, I do, and I can prove it. No, you don't. You do not own anything. I'm not being ugly, not being nasty, not trying to depress anyone. I'm just simply stating the fact you don't own anything. You say, well, Bob, what's the point of that? Well, there's actually a very good point to that. And I hope that you will pick up on that in the course of this lesson. I'm going to kind of try to allow you to discern it perhaps before I reach my conclusion. I'm not going to let you walk out the door without me telling you for certain what it is. But it's really very monumental. And it's actually very, very helpful. And in fact, it goes together with one of the lessons Sunday morning, the sermon on Sunday morning. And if you missed that particular lesson, I would encourage you to pick it up online. I don't know if it's online yet. Yes, it's already online. Please don't listen to it while I'm talking. No, I'm just kidding. I know you wouldn't do that. But I would encourage you to pick it up. Whether you hear it before or after you hear this one, I think you will see how important tonight's concept really is to what we talked about in that sermon. Now, I'm going to begin this evening by going to the book of Job. The book of Job is one of those books that, let's just face it, it's not read an awful lot unless you're dedicated enough to actually be reading through the Bible on a regular basis, or you have a dedicated study that's going to it. But it is a book that the Jews considered a part of what is the wisdom literature, and that's for a very good reason. It contains some incredible wisdom in a form that's strange to us. When you begin it and you have Job here, excuse me, you have God and he's talking to Satan and they're talking about Job, and then you have things happening, and then you've got the 3 friends, and then you've got these discourses going back and forth. In our Western minds, we're looking for more of a novel. And the Jews just didn't have novels. But you know what? They had something that was a lot better. And Job contains that. And it's called Hebrew poetry. And it's so powerful. I hope you'll learn about that and learn to use it. What I want to do here is I want to begin at verse 13 of Job chapter 1. Job chapter 1 and verse 13. And here we find that God and Satan have had their conversation, and Satan goes away, and the test is, you know, Job, he only serves you, God, because you've put a hedge about him, and he knows he's going to be blessed. And so basically it's the idea that as far as he's concerned, he gets paid for serving you. But if you did not bless him, he's not going to serve you. So here is where everything begins to really happen. Job 1:13. Now on the day when his sons and his daughters, that's Job's sons and daughters, were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." So imagine the tragedy of this. We find that we have the sons and daughters. They're all eating together. And we find they're in the oldest brother's house, and we find that the oxen are taken, the donkeys, all the servants are slain. There's just one servant that comes back, and he's the only survivor to tell the story. Verse 16, while he was still speaking, now this is going to happen pretty short order. It's rapid fire. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Okay, so you get the picture? Now we're only left with two servants out of those groups, and that's all that was left. So verse 17, while he was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Okay, we're coming down to it. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness, struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you. What do you end up with, Job? Right now, all he has left is his wife, his health, and four servants. And, by the way, he doesn't have anything for the servants to do. So, verse 20, then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshiped. That's interesting. You know, a lot of people today, when they come to this point in their lives, it's not worship that's on their mind. They're shaking their fist at the heavens above and saying, God, why did you do this to me? Why did you take away my servants? Why did you kill them? Why did you kill my sons and my daughters? Why did you take my donkeys? Why did you take my camels? Why did you take my sheep? All of my flocks and herds, you took them away from me. But that's not Job. Instead, he falls to the ground and worships. And he says in verse 21, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Through all of this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Job expresses something every believer will agree with until it's time to wrestle with this. You know, it's easy for those who have not lost to say that, yeah, well, if you lose, you should still utter these words, the Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. And you know, when we stand in the place of people who have not lost anything, we can say that very easily. But then everything changes when we lose, and the power of loss upon the human spirit, it becomes unimaginable. And you can lose in so many ways. There are so many ways that you can lose. A lot of parents are losing their children today to a spirit of disrespect. It's actually like a plague that's working on our young people, and it's even working on the children of members of the church, where those children just look back at their parents as if their parents have never done anything of any value for them. And they show them utter disrespect, and they act like they don't know anything, like they have no value, and they just want them out of their lives. That's a loss. That's a hard loss. If you lose your job, how does that feel to you? If you lose your job, is that unfair? Is that unfair? Have you ever been fired? If you lose your retirement account, years ago down in Houston, we were there at the time. Enron was blowing and going. And we knew people, good, loving, faithful, godly members of the church. who had their money there. That was their retirement. They worked for Enron. Overnight, it was gone. Was that fair? Was that fair? If you lose anything, to us, it just isn't right. It was ours. It belonged to us. And yet, before we suffer the loss, we can more easily look at Psalm 24, verses 1 and 2. And we can listen to the psalmist and say, yeah, that's right. Psalm 24, beginning in verse 1, the earth is the Lord's and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. We don't own anything. You know, there was a time years ago when I would say, you don't own anything but your soul. That's the only thing you have. And the truth is, actually, you don't own that. One day I suddenly came to this realization. You know, my soul doesn't even belong to me. There's nothing that belongs to us. They've been loaned to us by God. They've been placed in our hands for us to labor with to His glory. And this is where the word steward must now come to light. What is a steward? Because we all are stewards, and that is the only sense in which we, and I'm, for those who are listening to this on a recording, I'm putting this in air quotes, this is the only sense in which we own anything. We don't actually own it. It's just a stewardship that's been given to us. And a steward is basically a house servant. It's actually the word that's translated steward in our New Testament. It is from a compound word that literally meant house servant. And what you have here is you have someone who is so trusted that they have something that they are put in charge of. The English word steward in our Bibles is this house, I said house servant, it's house rule. It is this house rule where you have someone who's under a master, they're under the owner of the house, but they're given a rule over something. They're given charge over something. And this, of course, allowed the owner of the house to free himself up to go in other directions and do other things. Let me invite your attention to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, and it will illustrate very well this concept of stewardship and the benefit that it even had for an owner. So Luke chapter 12, we're going to begin here at verse 42. Luke 12 and verse 42. And the Lord said, who then is the faithful and sensible steward whom his master will put in charge of his servants to give them their rations at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. Now, he's not putting the steward, the servant, in charge of all the servant's possessions. We understand that. He's putting the servant in charge of all of the owner's possessions. Verse 45. But if that slave says in his heart, my master will be a long time in coming, and begins to beat the slaves, both men and women, and to eat and to drink and to get drunk, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. And that slave who knew his master's will and did not get ready or act in accord with his will shall receive many lashes. But the one who did not know it and committed deeds worthy of a flogging will receive but few. And from everyone who has been given much shall much be required, and to whom they entrusted much, of him they will ask all the more. Now you'll notice here that we have the slave. He's given us a certain rule within that house to do, but then we have the master coming and the slave has to give an account. The steward at some point has to open up the books, so to speak. Sometimes it was actually literal that he would open up the books. But he will have to open up the books and he will have to show that he has been faithful in his stewardship. If we look just a few chapters further in Luke chapter 16, Luke chapter 16, verses 1 and 2. Now Jesus was also saying to the disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and this steward was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. You see, this steward was called to account. I hear that you've been squandering. I hear that you've been pilfering. I hear that the accounts are not going to balance out right. And what I want us to understand is that the lives we have been given, to whatever degree of riches that we have, and I would suggest to you that while there may be some in this auditorium who feel like they don't have that much and others who feel like they have a lot, I would argue that we all have an awful lot when we look at history and the world around us. This is going to sound strange, but if you just stop and think about it, I feel incredibly blessed just to have indoor plumbing. Look back at history. Look at history. Even in this country. But then history into the millennia past. Indoor plumbing is priceless. Especially when you consider that possibly your grandfather or your great-grandfather, when he got up at 3 o'clock in the morning, his bathroom was not inside the house. And if it was January, you know what that feels like. Boy, that's riches untold, I've got to tell you. That's riches untold. But you know, you're probably going to have a warm bed tonight. You probably ate today. And there are some in this world who have neither. They did not eat today, and they don't know if they will eat tomorrow. And they won't have a warm bed tonight. I remember my wife was telling me about something that she saw. It was a comedian who was talking about a friend of his. And this comedian, I believe he was from Nigeria. I may have that wrong. But I believe he was from Nigeria, and he had a friend, and they were running around together, and the friend said, man, I'm starving. And this guy said, he looked at him and he said, you're starving. You're not starving. You're hungry. You go back to where I'm from and you find out what starving is. And you know, some of the times I'll say, oh, I'm starving because I'm hungry. The truth is, I'm not starving. And I know where my next meal will probably come from. And if I want it to come from there, it will come from there. The truth is, I'm blessed. I'm blessed. And I'm sure that you are as well. But the truth is, we don't own these things. But isn't it glorious that we have them? We'll say more about that going along. In the book of Isaiah, please turn to Isaiah chapter 22. In the book of Isaiah, we have a steward that's mentioned there. He was a high official in Hezekiah's court. Now you'll remember that Hezekiah was a king of Judah. He was a king of the southern kingdom, and he was a good king. He messed up down along the road, but he was a good king, and he was esteemed a good king all the way down the line, even though he did, well, anyway. When we look at this particular man, his name was Shebna, and we look at him, he was a steward in the king's household, which means that he had a very high position, and he had a very high position in a rich, affluent, powerful house. Now, we don't know much about Shebna. We kind of guess about him a little bit. There is some what we might just kind of carry over from maybe science, the idea of interpolating between things. And so we have a little bit of interpolation in what we think was going on here. It looks like Shebna was a foreigner. But he was taking heirs to himself, and he was building his tomb there in Jerusalem. But more than that, he was not on God's side with regard to what was going on with the approaching Assyrians and such. So let's begin a reading here at verse 15, Isaiah 22 and verse 15. Thus saith the Lord God of hosts, come, go to this steward, to Shebna, who is in charge of the royal household. What right do you have here? That and the fact that the name seems to be foreign is why we think perhaps he was foreign. What right do you have here? And whom do you have here that you have hewn a tomb for yourself here? You who hew a tomb on the height, you who carve a resting place for yourself in the rock. Behold, the Lord is about to hurl you headlong, O man, and he is about to grasp you firmly and roll you tightly like a ball to be cast into a vast country. There you will die. There your splendid chariots will be. You shame of your master's house. And I will depose you from your office, and I will pull you down from your station. Then it will come about in that day that I will summon my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your tunic and tie your sash securely about him. I will entrust him with your authority, and he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one will open. When we look at this steward, we find someone who God deemed to be unworthy. He was incompetent. He did not belong where he was. He was not doing what he was supposed to do. There is a good case to be made for him actually being in league with those who would seek the aid of Assyria and possibly even Egypt to the south, which the Lord did not want them doing. He wanted them to trust in him. But Eliakim would. He was worthy of this stewardship. And the truth is, it didn't belong to Shebna, even though it was a royal position, even though he was so high and lofty in power, it did not belong to him. And by the way, he was a steward in Hezekiah's house, and Hezekiah was the king, and it wasn't even Hezekiah's call. It was God's call. Why? Because it all belongs to God. And so, I want us to understand tonight that as we look at this idea of us not actually owning anything, and this isn't really going anywhere. There we go. Okay. So, what we have is a stewardship from God, and I want you to see what this entails. And don't get depressed, because this actually has a rosy picture at the end of it. But it also has a value to us in living this life. As we saw at the beginning from Psalm 24, this earth is the Lord's and all it contains. So think about this for just a moment. What belongs to the Lord and what belongs to us? Nothing belongs to us. The earth, the oceans, the mountains, the lakes. That means I don't own my house. Don't care how much you paid for it. I don't care what the escrow was on it. I don't care what the value on Zillow is. It doesn't matter. You don't own it. It doesn't belong to you. You say, well, Bob, I have a deed. And you can call up the title company and they'll tell you, well, I understand all of that. And I understand the concept of ownership as we use it. And I'm not saying we ought to never talk about owning anything again. That's not the point. The point is, in actuality, it really does not belong to us. And we ought to understand that as servants of the Lord. You don't own your car or your truck. It was made out of elements in the earth. And yes, man in his wonderful wisdom formulated the chemistry to create some of the materials in your vehicle. And the software, the electronics, wonderful ingenuity of man still doesn't belong to any of us. You don't own your most prized piece of jewelry, ladies. Just doesn't belong to you, no matter how much you pay. You don't own your business. You don't own your retirement account, 401ks, your IRAs. It's just, it actually isn't yours. God created the sun, the moon, and the stars. If you have a piece of jewelry made from something that fell out of space, it's still His. It still belongs to Him. The U.S. planted a flag on the moon. We don't own it. It's not ours. We sent a probe to rove on Mars. We don't own it. He created our souls. He gave us life in the very beginning. People talk about having rights over their own actions. You know, this becomes the big issue in abortion. Well, you know, it's a woman's right. Her body doesn't belong to her, much less the fetus that's in her womb. She does not have a right to take the life of a fetus that doesn't belong to her to begin with. That life belongs to God, just as your life and my life belongs to God. And the truth is, our very souls belong to God. Your children don't belong to you. Your husband doesn't belong to you. Your wife doesn't belong to you. And yes, I know the accommodative sense in which the husband and wife, they'll look lovingly, you know, cow-eyed into each other's eyes and they'll say, oh, darling, you belong to me. And the truth is, he or she doesn't. In the absolute sense. Now, in the sense of the covenant that you made with each other, I understand that. And yes, do not underestimate that. Here's a big one. The church does not belong to us. I don't care what anyone makes as a sign to go out front and what it says and what their doctrines are. What their church is all about, I don't care what it is, none of it belongs to a human being. And the church of the Lord, most importantly, does not belong to us. It's not ours. And if the church does not belong to us, then we don't get to call it whatever we want. And if you don't think that's a problem, then come up to Charlotte and drive around a little bit. Or even go to Columbia and West Columbia and drive around a little bit. You can see it here in Camden. It may not be quite as much on display, but it seems like every street corner someone's sticking out a religious sign for some church and it's got a name that they concocted. We don't get to name the Lord's church. The truth is, if we name it what we want, then it is not His church. We've stolen it. We don't get to let it do whatever we want it to do. And this is a problem that has been in place and continues to grow. And it's the idea that people who become members of a church think the church ought to do whatever the members really feel emotionally charged about. And so I'm feeling emotionally charged about the people who need blood up in the hospital, and we need to get the Red Cross blood mobile to come and sit in our parking lot, and we'll give blood, and we'll get the community to give blood, and we'll look good, and we'll draw people in. Well, it just doesn't work like that, actually. But we feel good when it's all said and done. And the truth is, the church doesn't belong to us for us to make those decisions. It belongs to the Lord. And the Lord, He told us what He wants it to be. People wonder, well, why in the world do you people in the Church of Christ, they'll call us Church of Christers, I still haven't figured that out. But they'll say, why in the world do you people in the Church of Christ, why do you insist on just doing things certain ways to the exclusion of the things all of your religious neighbors are doing? And the reason is right here. It doesn't belong to us, it belongs to the Lord, and we need to find out, Lord, what do you want? This great blood-bought institution didn't have Jesus' blood shed for it so it could take care of your kids while you go to work or go to school. Or is that a worthwhile endeavor? I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying it's not the work of the church. And so many other things. The church just does not belong to us. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15, the Apostle Paul called the church the household of God. Okay, it's the household of God. So what is the household going to do? Is it going to do whatever the children want? Or whatever the father wants? And isn't that a problem in our society today? Households are doing what the children want. And the parents have no authority. So I guess this point is lost on people. But the truth is, the Father has said, He has spoken. And we're the household of God. And we're His children. We're not in charge. At all. We don't own the church. Here's a big one that people don't get. We do not own the worship of the church. The worship of the church. Why have we done what we've done here this evening? Some churches would have made this a big, spectacular, emotional frenzy. And everybody would be excited and they'd be jumping around and they'd be waving their hands and clapping and, well, that's all fun. We don't own the worship of the church, and what the Lord has said gives us the picture of simple worship where we sing and make melody in our hearts. Ephesians 5:19 and Colossians 3:16. In doing that, according to Ephesians 5:19, we're not playing to one another on a guitar or on a piano or an organ or a saxophone. We're speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. How would you do that? You will do that in a way that it will foster the growth of everyone present as we speak to one another. And in so doing, we offer worship to our God. We've prayed. The prayer offered was a heartfelt prayer. It was a prayer that called upon the will of God and simply wanted God to show His favor and give guidance and strength and help and edification. Yesterday, we partook of the Lord's Supper. We did simply what God's Word said. But what we didn't do was we didn't turn the lights off so that we would all feel closer, get in a circle, hold hands. We didn't have someone just spontaneously start a song. with no warning. We didn't have applause in the midst of it when people liked what was going on. Everything was done in an orderly way, in such a way that we very simply worshiped our God without gimmicks. Some of our brethren are going in for these. It's heartbreaking. But you know what Jesus said. John chapter 4 and verse 24. God is a spirit, and those who worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. So what do we need to do? We need to look for the truth in order to find what God wants us to do in worship. These are the ones, verse 23, that God is looking for to be His worshipers. To worship means to adore. And I would simply ask you, can you adore God while you ignore God? Can you adore God while you ignore God? I deny that you can. Now, here's a really good one. This may be the hardest one of all. Our time does not belong to us. It belongs to God. People get kind of incensed. The idea that come on Sunday? Well, okay, they'll come for the worship service, but they're not going to come for a Bible study. What, come three times on Sunday? Are you crazy? Have you lost your mind? You see, their time belongs to them. Wednesday night, God did not say anything about gathering on Wednesday night. Let us consider how to stimulate one another into love and good works. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23. He there in verse 24 encourages them to be a strength to one another. But in order to do that, he says something in verse 25, and that is not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together, as is the manner of some. If there's a time to assemble, my time isn't mine. It's His. And I need to give it to Him. And so we put all of these together. We don't own these things. They don't belong to us. And we don't like that. And there may be someone, if not several, here who are just getting kind of perturbed with Bob because he's telling you, you don't own anything. It just doesn't belong to you. Well, please indulge me a little bit further, and maybe we'll get the point here. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. Beginning in verse 1, of course you may recall that the Corinthians had some troubles. They had some problems. There was fussing between them. There was some false doctrine there with regard to the resurrection. Some were trying to dominate others in all of this. There were cliques going on. Corinth was a mess. And Paul wrote to them in chapter 4 and verse 1 of 1 Corinthians, let a man regard us in this manner as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Now, the Apostle Paul is referring to himself, and in the context, you know, we might say to the other apostles, but that's really not specifically who he has in mind here, I believe. I believe who he has in mind here are those that he named together with him in the labors back in chapter 1. And he and the most closely associated in that is Apollos, one planted and one watered. So you've got both of them involved in that. But then we also have some there who have called upon Peter as being the one that they are of, and possibly Peter is a part of that. But I think the whole point is that those who have labored over what we have in Corinth is what he's talking about. Let a man regard us, not everybody, and it's not every Christian. It's about, in particular, Paul and Apollos and any others involved in that vein, that you regard us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. In this case, moreover, listen to it, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. And Paul makes the argument here that, and of course in 1 Corinthians, he is trustworthy. And he has been a good steward of God. But what I want us to get out of this is that we aren't just accountable for what we have done. We're held accountable for how we've handled the gifts God has put into our hands. And some of the times we're going to be held accountable for what we have not done. And we need to be very, very careful of that. These were not gifts for us to decide when to turn them on and turn them off in some cases. When it comes to serving God, it's time to serve Him, and it's always time to live for Him. And we can't turn that off when we leave the church building. And I know that everybody here, I'm kind of preaching to the choir in that regard, aren't I? But I think we all realize that. You leave the church building and you can't turn it off. You're still living it. And we have to use our lives in glory to God. They're a stewardship, and we're to use them carefully. And so I draw your attention back to two passages very quickly as I slide into my conclusion. Luke chapter 16 is the first one. Luke chapter 16, and you may recall that we have here a certain rich man who has a steward, and the steward is reported to him as squandering, and he calls the steward, and what he says to the steward is, give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. Everything we have belongs to God. And we are stewards of what He has placed in our hands. And we need to understand that we are going to give an account. And so with that, if you want to keep your thumb here to kind of compare the two passages, turn over to the book of Romans chapter 14. Romans 14 and verse 12. In Romans chapter 14 and verse 12, the Apostle Paul makes the point with regard to that great judgment on the last day. So then each one of us shall give account of himself to God. We're going to be like that steward at the beginning of Luke chapter 16. Now, do you find this depressing? Do you find it depressing that you don't own anything? Well, let me make sure we get the point so that you understand. First of all, if you don't own anything, then you can't lose anything. That's an interesting thing about people who have the attitude that they have in their loss. Let me just carry your mind back to Job for just a moment. How in the world did Job take all of that punishing loss in the first two chapters of Job? How did he take them so well? Now, I'm not saying that he was not hurt. I'm not saying that he did not become despondent. I mean, you can go to chapter 3 and you can look at him and you can see him and he's just sitting there in the dust of the ground. And he's not saying a thing. He's wounded and undoubtedly felt like he was mortally wounded. And yet still he was a man who could say, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." How does he do that? I'll tell you how I believe he did that. He understood that none of that belonged to him to begin with. Because do you remember what he said before he said, "Blessed be the name of the Lord"? "The Lord has given, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." He knew that it was God's all along, and that he was a steward, and God could do whatever he wanted with it. And so if you don't own anything, then you can't actually lose it. And the better we get that in our mind, then the better we're able to handle what we talked about Sunday morning in that sermon with regard to discouragement in serving God. Discouragements are going to come upon us in serving God. And the better we prepare our minds for them, the better we will be able to handle those discouragements and even the depression that might try to come upon us in the midst of great losses in this life. Loss becomes a major cause of depression in people. But the words of Job are incredibly powerful. But now, in the face of any perceived loss, we have to concentrate on what God truly has in store for us. Please turn to the book of Galatians. We're going to go to Galatians chapter 4. We could actually pursue this by going back into the end of chapter 3. The context, obviously, is running out of chapter 3 into chapter 4. But I want to notice a few things here in Galatians 4 so that you can see how wonderful we actually have it, even though we don't own anything. Galatians 4, verse 1. "Now I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a slave, although he is owner of everything. Why does he not differ at all from a slave? Because the child, even though he's owner of everything, he has no power over any of it. His father still has the power over it. He does not have anything that he can do. He's put under a guardian or a pedagogue, as the Apostle Paul points out back in chapter 3. And he's under this servant, and the servant is in charge of the child, who is the heir of everything. Even though the child owns everything. But he doesn't get everything yet, you see, because he's not ready to get everything yet. But now drop to verse 6. Chapter 4 and verse 6. "And because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, 'Abba, Father.'" Now I want to stop right there for just a moment. When it says that God sent forth the Spirit of his Son into our heart, I believe he's saying exactly the same thing as he says to the Romans in Romans chapter 8 and verse 15. There he also speaks of God sending his Spirit, but there he draws the context out more immediately. What he means by sending the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, he means the disposition of his Son, the attitude of his Son. See, we see Spirit, we immediately think Holy Ghost. That's not the point. The point is that we are sons. And what he has done is he has sent that sonship disposition, that disposition of being a son, that attitude of being a son, he sent that into our hearts. Rather than us being a servant or a slave, we have been given the disposition or attitudes of sons. How can I be sure that that's the point that he's making here in Galatians? It's obvious in Romans 8. Is it obvious here? Yes, it is. Look at verse 7. Therefore, remember what a therefore is there for. It's there to draw a conclusion. Therefore, you are no longer a slave, but a son. Stop. What did he just say? He just said, you're no longer a slave. What you are is you're a son. What is that about? What that is about is he sent forth the spirit of his son. His son had a disposition or an attitude of being a son. And he's given us that same disposition. And so you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. Listen to that. You and me, we are heirs. I don't own anything. It doesn't belong to me. It all belongs to God. But that's fine. Actually, it's wonderful because God has made me an heir. And what he has made me an heir of is all things. He's made me an heir of glory in heaven. He's made me an heir to a place in his very presence in eternity to worship and glorify him, to bask in his beauty, his love, his generosity, his kindness, his mercy, grace, and love. And there I will have the most perfect existence that I could ever have because he made me a son. I don't own anything. But I'm the richest man in the world. Is that your attitude? It should be. We need to realize that there is a true treasure, and that true treasure is in Jesus Christ. And whatever this world throws at us, that true treasure is the true joy. It's what we're really looking for. It's really what God placed within us that Solomon spoke of in Ecclesiastes 3. He set eternity in our hearts. And it's the true longing that we have. So what about you? Are you not yet a child of God? Have you not yet become a child? Because I'm going to tell you right now, being a child of God is how you become an heir to these things. Do you want to not own anything and that be it? Or do you want to not own anything and yet be heir to all things? Jesus Christ makes all the difference in the world there. So what about you? Where are you at? Do you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? Repent. Change your mind about this world and the way you look at things. And turn your life, your heart to Jesus. Confess him as the Christ. Be baptized into him and rise to walk in newness of life. And then live for him. Live for him because we belong to him. And because he has something far greater for us. Won't you take him up on this great estate and come while together we stand and while we sing.